Coming up on Tech News Today, why smart TVs are never smart enough, why Nintendo might be bailing on the Wii U, why size matters when you're talking about phones, and why maybe the internet isn't the best source for naming your research boat. All that and more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1475, recorded Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action.
And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about technology news with people who love technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. Welcoming back to the show. It's always awesome having Becky Worley on the show. How's it going, Becky?
It's going great. I am indeed a person who loves technology, but with a caveat, when it works.
That's a pretty big caveat, actually.
Well, you know, back in the tech TV days, we used to like it when it didn't work because that's how we had a job, right?
Job security, just not live on the air.
I suppose so. I like technology that aims to simplify things and then actually does, you know, instead of overcomplicating things in the process, like universal remotes. We're getting rid of our universal remote. I got it at the beginning for Christmas for my wife because I wanted to simplify our setup. And we've decided, no, all it's done is cause chaos and confusion. We're getting rid of it. There's got to be a better way.
You know, there's a story coming up in our little lineup here that involves a universal remote. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a sneak peek with a prop I brought with me. This is the remote as I configure it when my parents come to take care of the kids. It has a piece of paper or cardboard, and it only lets them press, it has cutouts. It only lets them press the on button, the input, the volume up and down.
That is brilliant.
That really is great. You should patent
that. We'll get to that later.
I think that there's like a cottage industry that can be created for like overlay templates for when people visit. You'd be like, this is all you need. Just snap it on. I think that's awesome, Becky. So that's a little bit later in the show. But before that, some sad news here at the top. A Silicon Valley legend has passed away. The news was announced last night that former Intel CEO Andy Grove had passed at the age of 79. Andy Grove was the first hire at Intel back in 1968. He later became president of Intel in 1979 and CEO in 87. And in a move that has characterized his brilliance in the tech industry, he was instrumental in taking Intel's successful DRAM business and switching the company's focus entirely to its microprocessor business, a big gamble that basically ultimately resulted in Intel becoming the world's largest semiconductor manufacturer. So really kind of took a gamble early on that really didn't, you know, I mean, it was exactly that. It was like, this could make or break the company, and we're doing okay, but you're making this big change. It's very out of the norm, and it ended up being a big success, to say the least.
Yeah, I feel like he's one of the founding fathers of Silicon Valley. He really is. He was, you know, there from the beginning, and he wasn't like the Steve Jobs crazy type. He was very calm, like in Walter Isaacson's book, if you read that, about Steve Jobs, there's a lot of passages where, like, Jobs was kind of going off the deep end, and Grove was a mentor to him and really calmed him down. Like, you know, there were notes back and forth to them saying, like, well, thank you for helping me along with that project with Pixar and all through the history. It's amazing, and it's definitely a loss.
I knew who Andy Grove was by name and just associated him with that sort of founding engineer type that came out of Xerox PARC in the early Intel Silicon Valley days. But what I didn't understand about him until I really did my homework today was that he created so much of Silicon Valley's culture, the dressed down, sort of the cubes as opposed to offices. And his gift was management. And nobody really talks about management in Silicon Valley. It's all about innovation, disruption, and entrepreneurship. But he really was the key facet in making Intel, as it was described, the best managed company in Silicon Valley, and many said in the U.S. And he wrote a management book that is a Bible for so many, as he also mentored so many of these up-and-coming entrepreneurs, from Steve Jobs to Larry Ellison to Mark Zuckerberg. And the book that he really made, he took the time to write a book, High Output Management, and just has some great nuggets of detail-oriented management that works with engineers and entrepreneurs. Fix problems when they're small. Measure what's important and set a standard. You think about how important metrics and data are now. He really made a point about delegating what you know, but individually have managers tackle what they don't know. Kind of counterintuitive, but just really specific management advice for the modern Silicon Valley environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to say, and you know, you're saying influential on that regard, like to say the least. He's also written another book, Only the Paranoid Survive. And I mean, when you kind of actually read into, so many things are written about this guy today. Dean Takahashi, by the way, VentureBeat, wrote up a really just an incredible write up. And when you kind of read, you know, how kind of tech luminaries are responding, I mean, so many of them were directly influenced, not only by, you know, the kind of legacy that he led before him, but just kind of his solutions to how you lead a successful company and a successful business. And, you know, he details that very thoroughly in these books. Mm-hmm. So highly recommend it.
Yeah. And when we think about books now, we're like, oh, well, everybody wrote a book. But I mean, this was the mid-90s when Only the Paranoid Survived was first written. I remember I worked in a bookstore, and that was the same year that The Road Ahead, the Bill Gates book, came out. This was the way people communicated back then, through books, through memoirs.
Yeah,
it wasn't,
true.
You know, there wasn't VentureBeat or, you know, all these websites that we check every day. So, yeah, definitely a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an update to news that broke late yesterday, just before we started the show. We have now confirmed that the Department of Justice has asked for a postponement of their court date with Apple. They've asked for 2 additional weeks to crack the terrorists' iPhone 5C themselves. Now, many security experts have theorized about the methods the FBI is going to use to crack the phone and what stage they're at in cracking it. My favorite method so far is that of iPhone developer Jonathan Zdarsky, who thinks they're planning to use a NAND mirroring technique. Zdarsky likens this to cheating at Super Mario Brothers with a save game that allows you to play the same level over and over again after you keep dying. So sort of, you know, cracking the password that way. Zdarsky and others think they've already developed this technique, and they'll take the next 2 weeks to test it. And in case you were wondering, this technique would not work on a phone with an A7 chip or with a secure enclave.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, big news. What do we think?
Well, I like the theory that instead of asking Apple to open up the phone for them, that this is going in the direction of where I think the best solution is for all involved, which is sort of the arms race of encryption and decrypting for law enforcement. And what I mean by that is, you know, we talked about this in the past, that the worst case scenario some experts have laid out is that Apple and other hardware manufacturers are forced to sort of have a compliance department where low-level employees are acting on all of these warrants to crack open phones. And if they have the key and are therefore sort of just going through the perfunctory job of opening up all these phones, that access to that technology to open up the phones being in the hands of folks doing this at Apple or Samsung or HTC or wherever the hardware manufacturer is, that's when it's going to get out and be available to anyone to decrypt phones. And I liked Susan Landau, who spoke at the congressional hearings, and she's a cybersecurity professor at, I think, Worcester, somewhere out east. And she said that it's the best case scenario for solving this problem is, and I'm going to quote here, law enforcement must develop the capability for conducting such investigations themselves, either in-house or through carefully managed contracting. And that it should be sort of something that the law enforcement agencies take on by themselves, that they manage, and that they don't outsource, because that's the trouble she thinks is when it will get into the hands of criminals to be able to decrypt these phones.
Which, I mean, definitely what we've also seen over time here is that or what we assume is happening behind the scenes based on what we're finding out here is that they've been pummeled by, you know, air quotes, solution after solution after solution. People who potentially have a solution to the problem. Now that there's one solution that they think might actually work, they're going for it. But I understand what you're saying, Becky, like, it's kind of incumbent upon them to kind of figure this out, right? Like it's an interesting interesting approach to kind of crowdsource it and go after Apple because they really, you know, supposedly anyways, had no way to get into it. I can't help but feel like the timing of everything is just so dang coincidental. Or is it? What do you think about that?
It's difficult with the attacks in Brussels. It definitely puts, another feather in and puts some of the weight back on law enforcement asking for help with terrorism. But on the other side of the coin, I do think that the FBI has really underestimated the civil liberties response from the public that has come down over the last month. I mean, my second grader came home from school last week and said that in social studies, they talked about Apple versus the FBI and that their whole class voted with Apple. Second
Interesting.
Graders.
Well,
that's why second graders don't get to actually vote. Yeah, I mean it is interesting. And in Brussels, the in France, the attack there, they used burner phones. I mean, that's what they found out. They weren't, no phone to be, to be cracked there. I think the timing isn't coincidental. I think they were probably working as hard as they could to find a solution. I mean, there were all kinds of other they were going to use lasers or acid, but then those solutions, you might be able to somehow get to the information on the phone, then if you didn't get the information, then the phone would be
destroyed.
And
yeah.
So, they have two more weeks to try to figure this out and then go back to Apple. I don't know. I mean, it sort of breaks down what the original argument is, which is, Apple does not believe that it's their responsibility to create this government OS. But the bigger question is still there. Like, someone's going to crack it, and it's, it's out there, and you can't put it back, can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Sure. I mean, is it different? Is it different when it comes from Apple on an OS level versus just a hack to get around it? Because I feel like hacks are kind of happening all the time. But a company like Apple creating a true kind of like alternate version of its OS to allow for access maybe is of a different level.
I think it's different because, this is very specific to this phone, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, so was the government OS that they were asked to create.
Yeah.
So one sidebar in this, I'm curious your opinion on this ethical issue, which is, let's say that it does go, instead of the future going towards Apple being forced to open phones for law enforcement agencies, and instead it goes to this sort of arms race where law enforcement agencies are trying to find their own ways into locked and encrypted phones. Mm-hmm. Let's say they use a zero-day exploit, the law enforcement agency, the FBI or the NSA does. Are they ethically bound to inform Apple because that same zero-day exploit could affect all users?
That's a good question.
That's a hard one to answer, right? I mean, and it actually ties in partially here. Apple really, I mean, obviously, now that Apple knows that there's a potential way in, it really wants to talk to the person or the people behind that. It wants to know all about the exploit. And in fact, Apple might not get access to it. So I think the inclination is that, yes, Apple absolutely wants access to it. They might not get access, though, to it if the Department of Justice drops its case entirely. Then Apple isn't owed that and might not ever get it. So ethically, I don't know if they should, because it certainly means a stronger operating system and a stronger, you know, device and all that kind of stuff, which everybody, of course, wants security. But I don't know. That could also be a very handy tool for a government agency to have access to and to just kind of keep for when it needs it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes a cat and mouse game.
And
to some extent, I feel like it's live by the sword, die by the sword, not to mix my metaphors here. But if Apple's not willing to play ball and help the government on this, then why should the government give up its only tools into the phone? I'm sort of looking at it from both sides, but it poses a whole new set of interesting questions.
Yes, yeah, it does.
It comes down to those cryptographers or the forensics experts, who do they want to give their information to? You know, there was the cryptographer that we talked about yesterday that found the vulnerability in iMessage, and they went to Apple. I mean, that's what a lot of them do, and you know, they get paid well for it. Probably they get also paid well from the government.
I mean, this is probably the hottest ticket around. If you're a, you know, let's say a white hat hacker or just a hacker, you know, looking to make a name for yourself, if you could actually be the one to figure this out, hey, you probably employed. You know what I mean? Like, there's probably a lot of benefit to people in this regard, searching for the solution to this.
So. Yeah.
Okay, so this next story definitely speaks to me. I'm a tall dude with an undeniable slouch that's the result of a world that is built for people much shorter than I am. But it turns out tall people aren't the only ones battling this inclination to slouch. We've all grown, I'd say, pretty accustomed to the posture of a person that's kind of looking into their smartphone or device, right? It's like the eye hunch posture. Your neck's forward, your head's tilted down because your device is down here. You're just kind of... You know, I mean, you walk around, you see people walking down the street, and they've got that kind of posture. Rarely, if ever, do people hold the device up in front of their eyeballs. It's always down and slouchy. According to research, posture has a direct effect on hormone levels. It increases cortisol, which sends the body into a state of fight or flight. It also decreases testosterone, which has been linked to depression and low libido. Well, thanks to biological programming that once actually helped protect us from predators, where we, you know, shrink from danger by slouching, our bodies regularly dip into that historical well, which can result in a sort of depressive state over time. It's kind of like when you smell something and it takes you back to a particular memory, that sort of thing built into us. So then the studies all kind of point to, if all we are doing is looking at our devices like this, head slouched forward, rounded posture, all this kind of stuff, what we're actually doing is we're becoming more depressive people in the long run because we spend so much of our time doing this. I don't know.
So
what do you guys think?
We should keep our devices right
right
in front of our faces, over our eyes.
That's what they recommend. this is you next time you're checking your smartphone.
That's one solution. The other solution is to put down our devices when we're with other people or just for at least 5 or 10 minutes a day. What do you think, Becky?
Well, when I read this story, you know, the correlation between posture and these weird, you know, the way that your smartphones make you feel, it was kind of bizarre to think that it's the posture that's causal. And then I have a little experiment for you guys and for everyone at home to play along. So just bear with me for 1 second. I want you to just imagine doing these tasks or these activities, I'm going to say. And then when you finish after doing them for 20 minutes or so, imagine how you feel. So how do you feel after you have dinner with a friend?
I'm holding it.
Hold it.
Okay.
I'm allowing for radio silence. Forgive me.
Okay.
So have dinner with a friend.
Okay.
Next, play a board game with a kid. Mm-hmm. Imagine your feelings. Next, you've been checking Facebook for 20 minutes. And the next one is...
I just dropped. Yeah.
Right. You've been playing a game on your phone.
Mm.
Like, can you... Like, I thought it was interesting to just imagine the different... feelings you have, and it's based on, I don't know, having dinner with a friend afterwards, I don't feel the same way I do after I check Facebook for 20 minutes.
Yes.
Is that because of the way I sat? Is that because it's a richer experience? Is that,
probably,
I don't know.
A combination, I would have to imagine. Yeah, it's hard to accept that something as, you know, I don't know what it is, but you know, posture is just the thing that we either do or we don't think about, but we don't ever think about it in the context of how it makes us feel. We just think about it as this thing we have to like nag ourselves to do, or at least that's me, because I'm always nagging myself to stand up straighter. Actually understanding how that could possibly influence the relationships you have in life, and you know, and beyond that, just kind of how you feel, like, I suppose that's just a different world entirely. But as you were kind of illustrating those different topics, I will definitely say I slouched a lot when you said the word Facebook. So I don't know what that means.
No, I mean, we do always talk about like, oh, how bad you feel after you spend 15 or 20 minutes on Facebook, and you think it's, well, you know, because I don't know why, but yeah, maybe it is because it's not because of what you're seeing or like some kind of schadenfreude you're having or, you know, you envy. Maybe it is how you're sitting. Yeah. I don't know if you do much yoga, but a lot of yoga is, you know, this is how your body is.
Well, and that's part of what they recommend is after you spend a lot of time on your phone, raise your hands in the air and do a little,
like you
and
just, you know, don't care.
Yeah, like you just don't care. Maybe shake it a little bit, but kind of do that open posture to kind of like offset it and whatever. I don't know. Like some of this, as we're kind of talking about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, really? Is this really going on? But I don't know. I've spent a life trying to battle my hunched posture, and I don't like it. So maybe that's part of it. Maybe I'm like slightly depressed because of my posture.
You know what I'm going to do, Jason? The next time I see you, I'm going to take you to one of my bar classes. It's ballet bar, and you stand at the bar and you do these tiny little movements in your core. It's absolutely ridiculous. And by the end of it, you're crying.
I
now have very good posture because of this pain I endure for 2 hours every week. I'm going to take you.
Yeah. Okay. That's B-A-R-R-E, not the bar.
That's right.
I don't know. That sounds okay. All right. Well, I'm open to anything.
All right. Well, here's another story to cheer you up. It's World Water Day today. In honor of this, Tech Insider is highlighting a solution for a waterless toilet that is backed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The nano membrane toilet uses advanced technology, but no water. It's designed to be used in densely populated areas as opposed to rural areas because it must be serviced every 6 months. Now, this is not brand new. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has funded this since 2012, but it's fascinating. It turns waste into clean drinking water. I'm excited.
I was hoping they could put this like on every block in San Francisco because we have a wee bit of a public toilet problem. Mm-hmm. But
California also has a wee bit of a water problem, so there you go.
True. Yeah, I just like that we keep saying we.
Yeah.
A wee bit of a wee problem. It's actually really complicated technology that goes into this. It's basically separating solids from liquids, and then it's venting the solids. It's turning the waste into something that you can be extracted, but that's the downside. This serves 10 people for like a week, and then it needs to be emptied, and that seems like a problem.
Right. It requires somebody to maintain it, right? So it's not going to work in like your rural, you're out in the middle of nowhere, rural kind of poor areas, because someone actively needs to come along every 5-6 months and maintain the technology, basically what's going on.
But in densely populated urban areas, waste problems are probably bigger than in rural areas.
That's true. A lot more people.
More waste.
A lot more.
Yeah,
no, that's very true.
It's more disease because that waste is in such dense places. And yet again, I mean, the Gates Foundation and what they do for world health in general, just all the things that they've been trying to innovate, it's so impressive in terms of their philanthropy. And I hope that this does lead, if not in this iteration, but down the road to something that does help with what's a problem that we really have no idea about in our day-to-day life, but clearly affects a lot of people around the world.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, finally, not nearly as important, but I still think it's kind of cool. Interesting anyway. Smart TVs. Am I right? You know what I'm talking about? Never smart enough. Always clunky. Always have their own little apps that aren't nearly as good as the actual apps we use on our phones and tablets, that sort of stuff. So what if a company like Vizio tossed out, all of the smart TV capabilities and in its place dropped in Google Cast functionality instead? Then the TV becomes a receiver, basically. The Vizio P-Series 4K high dynamic range TVs have done that, opting to ship with a 6-inch Android tablet that acts as the interface for the TV in place of the on-screen stuff that you normally have to do and manage and, you know, poke around in an awkward sort of way on the smart TV screen. Instead, you're basically doing this all on a tablet. Anyone who's had or has a Chromecast, I'm definitely a big fan of the Chromecast, is at least more familiar with kind of the approach here. The apps on your phone drive the content that you see on the screen. I've had nothing but great experiences with Chromecast. I think this is a fantastic idea after all of the horrible smart TV interfaces I've seen, and they always promise like they're going to get it right, and they never do. I hate them all. Becky, I know you have thoughts on this. What are your thoughts?
Well, Steve Jobs said that he didn't want to actually produce a television because it's impossible to keep to make it in a way that it will play nicely with all the other devices in your living room. And to the thing that I realized in thinking about what you just mentioned, all the apps that are on any TV you can turn around in the house that's been purchased in the last 10 years, you know, they're out of date at best and unusable is the norm. So I like the idea that those apps will be easily updated using the tablet that is sort of the remote. I like the idea that you can add more, that the whole operating system of that tablet can be updated, which basically updates all of the content players that you're using on your TV. Mm-hmm. But the biggest problem, that is not the hurdle in the quest for a really smart TV. The fundamental issues are input-output and playing nicely with all those other media sources, as I mentioned. I mean, when you try to enter your login information or anything on your TV, it's like texting on an old Nokia phone.
It's a nightmare.
It's miserable. Yeah. And so if this tablet helps with that in some ways, I do see that as a benefit, you know, whether you're searching. But it doesn't work with all your devices, and this leads to my second problem. It doesn't have an IR blaster. So it's not a universal remote,
right?
And so you're solely limited to having everything run through this, and all of your cable boxes, DVD players, yes, people still use those, any other input sources for media that you're trying to use, you go back to having another two or three remotes in my hand, and I bring back my fabulous TV remote with the holes that say, push here, Grandma, and then we're back to the same thing. I mean, seriously, my parents are so lovely. They come and take the kids sometimes if we're not here. Every single time I get a call, how do we turn on the Apple TV? How do we get it over back to the cable box? Just shoot me now.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you. I had that same exact experience this weekend with our babysitter, basically. It was a nightmare.
It's the babysitter problem. If we could get robot babysitters, they would know how to work the TV.
No, then we couldn't work
the
robots.
They would have their own IR blasters. Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we wouldn't know how to run the robots. Yeah, I am actually pretty surprised that they didn't include an IR blaster, because there are plenty of, let's say, just Android devices in general that actually have an IR blaster built into them. So you're taking your phone that can control your TV. It makes sense that if you're making a tablet that's controlling your TV and that's its dedicated function, that it would have an IR blaster so you can do some of that other stuff. But I like the starts of this. It does miss out on a few things. There's no TV tuner built in. So if you want to get an over-the-air signal, an HD signal, you're going to have to buy an extra component in order to do that. Amazon Prime Video is not a supporter of the what's now called Google Cast functionality. So if your content's in Amazon, that's not going to work. So there are some hurdles, but I don't know. Like this actually, when I saw it, I was like, this is the perfect TV for me. I already love Chromecast. I do think it's not Chromecast anymore. I keep saying that. It's just Cast. I do think that it's interesting that Android TV was built for more or less this kind of application to be built into a TV set. And more, it seems like Cast is winning out over Android TV as far as that's concerned. It's a lot more simple anyway, so.
The Amazon Prime problem is also the problem with the Apple TV, too. That's my only, yeah. I mean, with the latest update that they updated yesterday, they got rid of that problem with entering your passwords As long as you're not using your DVD player, like you said, or you don't want to watch Amazon Prime, like you use Siri on the remote, you can enter your passwords, you can say special characters, she'll recognize them. It's amazing. But yeah, you still can't get Amazon. So, it, you know, I think they have to come around.
Maybe.
Unless Alexa Amazon is going to turn into a TV. Sorry if I made your Alexa turn into a TV.
I wonder if Logitech would end up licensing their all of the technology that they have. And basically what they have is these immense databases of codes for remote controls. And if they'll end up licensing all of their codes and databases for all of these new devices so that they maybe can in the next iteration be those universal remotes while at the same time being the media sources that are upgradable and sort of running on Android or iOS in some form so that they are a little bit more nimble.
Well, after the break, Lauren Hawkinson is here to talk about the future of the Wii U. But first, let's thank ZipRecruiter for their support of this show. It is tough out there for job seekers, but it's not so easy for people looking to hire either. How do you find the best forensic expert to crack your iPhone 5C? How do you find the next Bill Gates or the next creator of the waterless toilet? And slouching over your phone all day looking through resumes, that's not going to do you any favors either. That's just going to make you depressed, as we learned. You want a better, faster solution. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates, and short staffing leaves little time to post to dozens of job sites. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over nearly 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is of utmost importance. Dan, a happy ZipRecruiter client, said the hardest part about running a business when you need to hire is that you have to spend extra time recruiting while you're short-staffed. But with ZipRecruiter, I've gotten quality candidates within 24 hours of posting a job. ZipRecruiter's website makes this process so much faster by letting me manage candidates in one place. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today.
All right, so the Nintendo Wii U has been around for 4 years now. Time flies. And a report from Japan's Nikkei claims to shed some light on its future. Joining us to talk all about it is Lauren Hawkinson from The Next Web. How's it going, Lauren?
Hi, guys. Going well.
Awesome. It's great to have you here. So what are we hearing about the future of the Wii U?
Yeah, so it doesn't look really good, to be honest with you. Japanese newspaper Nikkei basically said in a report that it was looking like Nintendo would be winding down production of the Wii U sometime this year, which means that the hardware console itself will stop being manufactured, and that'll be that.
Wow. Okay. So so it looks like 12.6 million units sold with the Wii U at this point. Is that a good or a bad showing for the console?
Well, in terms of numbers over a lifetime, especially a console's lifetime, that's fairly low, especially when you consider the success of the Wii U, which was incredible. I believe it ended up in total was more than 100 million units sold around the world.
Oh, for the first Wii. Yeah,
for the first Wii. Had it for, you know, forever. So, you know, that's really not a strong showing, especially considering that its little console, handheld console buddy, the 3DS, has sold over 50 million units.
Wow. Okay. This is a lot lower. Would this be the end to the production of just the console, do you think? Or would games still be produced? Because I know there, you know, many times the console's retired, and even for, you know, a number of years, games are produced for the console.
Yeah, exactly. For example, Microsoft still supports the Xbox 360, which is more than 10 years old, I think, at this point, which is remarkable. Yeah, I think that what you see in the latest generation, especially when games are released, a lot of third-party manufacturers, software developers decided that they would continue to support the Xbox 360 and the PS3, even though, you know, those production lines are winding down, as well as the Xbox One and the PS4. Nintendo is actually historically very good at backwards compatibility, so it's likely that they'll probably continue to do software offerings until their next big console comes through. which maybe this year, maybe next year, nobody's really quite sure. There's been a couple of rumors that it's much further along than many people think. But all in all, I think that it's probably safe to say that they will continue to support the Wii U software-wise, at least for some time.
Lauren, are you a personally a Wii U fan? Is it something that you do on your free time?
Yeah, and I can look. My little Wii U is like on its little base charging right by my television. I love it. I, you know, pop it off and I like to play my little Mario Maker. It's so much fun. But I also bought my Wii U last year, Black Friday, for a rock bottom sale, which I would say was probably the best value. I like to believe that there's kind of that maximum efficiency value point where your console, the console life is so far along that the price is good. And then based on the number of games that it has, right, it becomes this really great value. And I've been one of those people that's like that. The Wii U, you know, hasn't been a strong console, but it's got some great software on it and it could really provide a value, especially if you have a family. But if it is true and Nintendo will be shutting down the production line, it's really hard to recommend a console knowing that its life is being cut short.
Do we have any idea? So you mentioned a little bit about the kind of the successor, which, you know, we're hearing the name Nintendo NX. Do we know anything about it beyond just that at this point?
You know, not really. There have been some rumors floating around and also a picture of a controller. Some people are indicating that Nintendo will support a higher resolution than the Wii U. They might, you know, hint at some sort of motion novelty still within the product. But right now, it's still pretty amorphous. Nintendo likes to keep those things locked tight.
Lauren, is motion control dead for gaming in your sense, if in the next iterations and what we'll see?
Oh, absolutely not, because motion control is now becoming a crucial part to VR experiences. So what you're seeing is, especially with the dawn of the PlayStation 4 and the PlayStation VR, you can pop that headset on and then you have your motion controls. The PlayStation VR example, for example, uses the PlayStation camera and their branded Move controllers, which have been out actually for a while now. So you'll be able to sort of have more natural movement while you're playing VR, which I think is really the key goal, right? You don't want to sit on your couch and have a headset and play with a controller. You want to actually, you know, pick things up and move things around and shift things. And I think that that is really where motion control is going to be a crucial part, especially in VR, but also in general console gaming.
Nintendo's always been a budget family option. Mm-hmm. And with VR coming in, how do you think they'll be able to compete at the price point?
You know, I think that Nintendo has sort of shoved a wedge between itself and the Microsofts and Sonys of the world and sort of said, hey, this is really what we do. We've been doing it for a really long time and we're not going to change anytime soon. You're still going to be able to buy your console and get your Mario and have it be, you know, easy enough and friendly enough for your 5 or 6 year old to play. It's not going to be, you know, too much of a learning curve. But we'll also have some games that are going to be really valuable for people who are experienced gamers. It's just a different experience. I don't think that they're really going to be chasing after what other companies are doing. That's never really been their style. I think that it's more likely that they will continue to explore these new and novel options for family gaming rather than sort of relying on this, you know, VR or any other kind of new and trendy novelty wear in terms of consoles.
Yeah, kind of like avoiding the race to the top, high spec, does everything, you know, it's the future gaming system for the next 10 years. That hasn't proven to be kind of Nintendo's strategy over the years, it seems like.
Exactly, but you can also argue that it's proven to be a little bit of a tough spot for Nintendo as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Wii U is on purpose completely different from what people were expecting when it came out. And it is completely different from the PS4 and the Xbox One, and its game library is totally different. And a lot of people think that Nintendo's walled garden, as it were, has made it very difficult for games to really get in there, especially by third-party developers, that either you like Nintendo stuff or you don't like it. And if you don't like Nintendo stuff, you don't want anything to do with the console.
Right.
So I think that, you know, it's interesting. It's a part of Nintendo that doesn't look like it's going to be a huge success. But on the other hand, you know, their handheld console, the 3DS, has a novel concept built within it. It's a dual screened handheld with a 3D component, a passive 3D component. And still, you know, people love that machine. So I think that, you know, Nintendo is actually willing to play a little bit of hit or miss, believing that it'll strike the next big gaming novelty for families.
Yeah.
Well, real quick before we let you go, have you had a chance to try out Nintendo's new social network, Miitomo?
Miitomo.
Unfortunately, I haven't, but I've been waiting with bated breath, of course, because Miitomo is one of those weird and wacky Japanese style gaming experiences that you really, going to be an interesting thing once it comes out in the U.S. for the iPhone. For those who aren't familiar, Miitomo is the app that Nintendo was putting out, its first iOS app. It's currently released in Japan, and within 3 days, it had more than 1 million downloads. It's a big deal out there. You know, it's such a small population, so it's been the top of the charts there. But more or less, the whole object of Miitomo basically is that you are a little person in your phone. You have a little person in your phone. It's your Mii avatar. And it goes around and it visits people and it says really weird things and you do quizzes and it doesn't make any sense when you explain it. But once you download it, you sort of get it. It's like a Neko Atsume cat collector. It's like, mm-hmm. You know, it's Japanese and super weird and you don't know what the rules are. But once you start doing it, you can't stop.
I actually was able to install it on my Android device and played around with it at the end of last week and then realized I know nobody else that has it installed. Mm-hmm. So I kind of hit a wall. Yeah, there I am. There I am with obviously because I've got an umbrella, a fork and a chair behind me.
So. It's awesome. And it's really based off of, you know, a lot of people argue whether or not it's sort of a mobile take on Tamagotchi Life, which was a game that was actually released for the Nintendo 3DS and was similarly wacky. But I think that if it really gains traction in the U.S., it'll probably be something that's really fun, but you will not be able to explain it to your friends.
Yeah, I have a hard time explaining it to viewers. So
there or to me.
You did a much better job explaining it than I did. Thank you so much for joining us, as always, Lauren Hawkinson. Tell people where they can follow all the awesome work you do online.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am on Twitter at L Hawkinson. You can look me up on the Next Web. I also have a podcast, Another Random Musings, that is called Nothing Matters. That's about it. I just, lots of dog gifs. So if you are willing to follow that, then
hop on board. Excellent.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Dog gifs and subtle makeup.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lauren. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, it's time for our fan of the day. Paul Smith writes, I'm still using my 2011 iPhone 4S, currently running iOS 2.1.
9.2.1. 2.1 would be really old. 9.2.1.
The 4S was my first smartphone, and all these years later, it still does everything I want. Better than ever, for reasons I really don't understand, the new smaller iPhone SE has me interested in the idea of a new phone for the first time.
Feels like the very first time.
I mean, for reasons that you don't understand, because Apple really wants you to buy it, even if your current phone works perfectly well. That's what they would like for you to do.
I mean, he stuck it out.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Good work.
Paul really, hung in there. Is that a four-year-old device at this point?
Five-year-old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that because all the things that I want to run on an Android device, at least if an Android device is 5 years old, you feel it. Like, you really feel it. I don't know if you feel it on an iOS device as much as you do on Android, but if it's 5 years old, you're going to have a hard time running apps and stuff, and I would notice.
Yeah, well, in your job, yes, but everybody doesn't have your job where they review Android apps.
I think if you've got a five-year-old device and you're installing any sort of modern apps or anything like that, you're gonna notice whether you know that it's because of the old phone, old device, or because of the app or whatever. I don't know, but you would notice a slowdown.
Yeah, I have an iPad 1 that I couldn't upgrade past a certain point, and I definitely feel like, I can't do that. Ooh, you know, it's not. It's not because I'm testing things. It's just not, things I want to do that are normal everyday Joe stuff.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, yes, we swap phones pretty regularly around here and sometimes drop them too. Coming up, your puny little hands need puny little phones, and that's totally okay. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, Igloo Software. Anyone that's worked in a corporate environment knows how painful legacy intranets can be. The content is stale. The interface is ugly. You can only access it at work. Igloo is an intranet that you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, do things like collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, manage projects, the whole nine yards. It's built using responsive design, which means everything you can do at your desk, you can now do on the go through any web browser. And anyone can add content with drag and drop widgets, as well as a WYSIWYG editor that's provided. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Now, unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and coming soon, file sharing solutions like Box and Dropbox. It's great for growing companies and large enterprises looking to refresh their communication strategy. And it's used by government agencies as well as companies like Hulu, Inventive Health, American Family Insurance, and Ipswich. You can try it for free for yourself. Go to igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT. And we thank them for their support.
Yesterday, Android users had to suffer through all the Apple hype and marketing that we call news. Mm-hmm. But our next guest took the opportunity to write about how Android users should applaud some of the news in yesterday's Apple announcement. Welcome, J.R. Rayfield from Computer World.
Hey, good to see you guys. How are you?
Why should Android users be excited about yesterday's announcement of the iPhone SE?
You know, a funny thing happened over the last couple, 2-3 years where, and we saw it first in Android and then in the Apple world, where manufacturers have been telling us over and over and trying so hard to convince us that bigger is better and you've got to get this bigger screen, you can do so much more, everything's so much easier. So of course, it was only a matter of time until, you know, what's old is new again, and suddenly we're hearing about how, hey, this is compact, easy to carry in your hand, it's ergonomic. You knew it was going to happen, and here it is. But you know, from a broader perspective than just Apple, there are a lot of people, myself included, who have kind of begrudgingly accepted the fact that if you want a high-end phone, you're going to have something that's pretty big nowadays. I carry the Nexus 6P, and I've used that as an example a lot, where I love a lot of things about the phone, and I kind of accepted its size. I don't cherish its size. I just said, you know, if I want all these other factors, that's kind of what you got to do right now. And it's been quite a while since we've seen really good flagship caliber small phones in the Android realm, at least among companies that really are, you know, relevant and prominent here in the U.S. And so, you know, once something starts happening in the mobile ecosystem, whether on the Android side or the Apple side, it's usually just a matter of time until that trend spreads and becomes a bigger thing. And for all we know, there could already be wheels in motion for comeback phones to come back on the Android side already. It may have nothing to do with the Apple announcement. But one way or another, it seems likely we can at least be optimistic that maybe we'll get some, you know, decent high-end compact phones in Android again and have that as an option for people who don't want to carry something, you know, phablet size, as we say.
Well, so the Samsung Galaxy Alpha, that was a smaller, like a backwards, they went smaller with that phone, correct? And did that work out so well?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of random little devices here and there like that. But as far as phones that you can really find anywhere and that are flagship caliber, the only company that's really made that a priority lately with Android has been Sony with its Xperia Z, whatever, compact phones. And those are really nice devices generally. But just here in the U.S., they're not really part of the discussion even. You know, I think the previous year's one never really became available here at all. This year's showed up several months late with a key feature missing in the U.S. version. They stripped out the fingerprint sensor for some reason. And, you know, on top of that, it's pretty hard to find. You really have to go out of your way to find it. And it's not cheap. So it really hasn't been a priority for anyone, at least here in the States, for quite a while. The original Moto X was the last device that I think caught a lot of people's attention that was under the 5-inch screen size mark and still, you know, kind of a flagship level phone in its own way.
Yeah, like the Samsung Galaxy Alpha that you're talking about, like that was still a 4.7-inch display, which in light of like in the standard like Android device being around 5.2 to 5.3, you know, right around there, is smaller. But then, you know, yesterday's iPhone, that's a 4-inch device. Like that feels like I'm going to have to remember how small that actually is in reality. I'm definitely a big fan of the larger device, but I'm tall dude, big hand. So it just works for me a little bit better. But I feel like one of the things that comes up, and I don't know how Apple has addressed this or will have addressed this with the iPhone SE, is that when you have a smaller device, you just by sheer size have a smaller battery. And so when you take something like high-powered specs, things that draw a lot of power and what we expect out of high-performing devices, and then you couple that with a smaller battery just because the device itself is, in fact, smaller, I mean, do we feel like that's it's awesome to have the option, but are people going to be upset if the device doesn't, you know, let's say last all day or whatever?
Well, can I ask a question around that? Because I would presume that even though it's a smaller battery, it's a smaller power draw because you have less real estate to light up in the screen, no?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't speak specifically to the new iPhone. I haven't touched it and don't know anything specifically about it. But in general, I think what Becky said is a really good point, and that if done correctly and done well, can be the case. I can tell you with some of the past Sony Xperia Z compact devices, they've had among the best battery life of any phone I've used. And those were small in the four. They varied over the years, but 4-point-something inch. I think the last one was 4.6-inch screen. And yeah, because you do have less screen in terms of just sheer space. And then usually the resolution is a little lower because, you know, the smaller the size, you don't really need as high of a resolution. So that's less of a draw. So it really just depends. I mean, we've seen big phones with awful battery life and small phones with great battery life. Hopefully anyone who's doing it will take the time to do it well, and that won't be an issue. Because otherwise, yeah, that would definitely be, I think, a disappointment for most people.
Truth.
Guys, I have an iPhone 5 in one hand, and I have a Nexus. I'm not sure what is this, the new Nexus. Google just sent 6P. This to me. Yeah. And the way that I distinguish this as a woman is that the iPhone 5, which will have roughly the same size as the SE, is a first knuckler, meaning I can hold it in my hand, and it kind of rests in that first knuckle of my pointer finger, whereas the Nexus is like the end of my pointer finger. It's a last knuckler.
Yeah.
And it feels a little different in my hands. And as a woman, I have, you know, medium-sized girl hands, but it still feels too big in my... I won't say that. It still feels rather large. And so this conversation is really challenging to have.
nicely put.
So I feel like in some senses there's a user experience question here around holding the phone. But then my big question for you, JR, which is, you know, is this about putting it in your jeans pocket?
Oh, I think there's definitely something to be said for that. And it's personal preference. I mean, with men or women, I know people who prefer the larger phones. So you have to keep adding phones after every like inch measurement you give so it doesn't sound dirty. Some people prefer them larger. Some people prefer them smaller. Some people think 5 inches is just right.
Phones. Phones, just end every phones. Sentence with phones, and it makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, even for me personally, I mean, I have what I would call average size hands for a guy, and the Nexus 6P, I'm okay with it. I've gotten used to figure out how it shows to carrying it, and it's not bad. But certain pants, and I don't wear skinny jeans and nothing like that, but still, just certain pants, it's, you know, you're always aware of it. It doesn't quite. Fit comfortably in your pocket. If I'm wearing like gym shorts or something, you know, I always have to kind of keep a hand there. And I think even more so for absolutely in typical women's jeans, my wife looked at the two phones and I did a review before I even, you know, made a personal decision. So I had both the 5X, which is the smaller size, and the 6P. And again, to be clear, the 5X is not really what you'd call compact. It's just not as big within what we've defined as normal in the last few years. And, you know, she knew everything, my general thoughts on both, and that the 6P is really the better phone all around. The only thing is if you can accept the size. And despite all that, she decided it's just too much. And she's kind of gotten used to the 5X. But even that one, you know, is a little bigger than ideal for a lot of people. And my brother, who is, as you would suspect, a man, is kind of the same way. He found the 6P was just too uncomfortable to carry and too uncomfortable to hold. So he ended up getting the 5X. And even with that, still feels like he would rather have, you know, something closer to with like the first gen Moto X, which is what he had before. So yeah, I think there's a big market of people that has just kind of gone unaddressed with the way the trends have moved in the last couple of years. And certainly it's good to have the choice. And I wouldn't say big phones are terrible. People like them. But there are a lot of people who I think, given the choice and given the fact that you could get a good phone and not just compromising it, a so-so phone in a smaller size, would jump on that opportunity.
So if any Android users were watching the announcement yesterday, is there an Android phone that's comparable in your mind to the iPhone 6 SE?
Yeah, you know, I don't think there is, and that's kind of the problem. In terms of at least size, which is really the distinguishing factor, I think, with the 6E, we just really haven't seen anything in that realm. Again, other than Sony, which if you live in an area where that's a real choice, and that's great. Here, like we were saying before, you can find it, but it's not what I would call relevant. And aside from that, we just haven't seen anything that's small-ish, let alone like below the 5-inch size in phones in a while.
Well, I think we should probably quit while we're ahead. Thank you, JR, so much for joining us. JR Rayfiel is at jrstart.com and JR Rayfiel on Twitter. That's JRRAPHAEL. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always good to see you guys.
Take
care. Good to see you, JR. See ya. All right. TNT's fan of the day is at NordAltC on Twitter, who says, quote, I listen at work, gardening in West Cork. Happy Paddy's Day from Ireland. Love the show, Megan and Jason. And there you go. Good way to kind of pass the time. Have us channeled into your ears. We're going to help you with your gardening or whatever, or your dishes, or I don't know,
laundry,
whatever you happen to be doing. Yeah,
running,
okay, sure.
Walking.
We're gonna help you exist. That's what we're gonna do. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it to Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it.
After the break, why crowdsourcing is awesome, except when you're trying to name something. But first, let's take a minute to thank the Ring Video Doorbell for sponsoring this episode. I have never loved a doorbell before. I never thought that loving a doorbell was possible. In fact, I kind of hated my old doorbell, but I do love the Ring Video Doorbell. It helps me keep an eye on my house, my stuff, my dog, my kids. With the Ring Video Doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door, anywhere in the world, just using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't even ring the doorbell. With Ring Video Doorbell, you can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. If someone tries to mess with it, you'll get an instant alert and an HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. Now, if you follow me on Twitter or Facebook, you might already know that over the weekend, our car got broken into while we were in San Francisco. It was very sad. Our window was smashed. We were super lucky. Nothing got stolen but cash. But if you've ever been broken into, you know how violating it feels. Now, one of the things that made me think about after this happened was how much comfort I get just from having the Ring Video Doorbell. It's great for peace of mind. Installing the Ring takes minutes. It works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. Ring also has a new advanced Ring Video Doorbell that's $249. That starts shipping late April. So put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell that Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT. With Ring, you are always home. So, writing in the New York Times today, Katie Rogers tells the tale of one unsinkable idea by the British Natural Environment Research Council to use the internet to vote for the name that they could proudly emblazon on the hull of the UK's next world-class polar research ship, the current frontrunner. I can't even say it. It's too funny. The current frontrunner is Bodie McBoatface. So you have until April 16th to vote. Becky, Becky, what do you think about the name Bodie McBoatface?
Bodie McBoat. I can't even say it either. It just, I always wonder about these social media forays that go horribly wrong. Are they actually so disastrous that they're incredibly successful? I mean, we're talking about this research vessel. Isn't that why they did this in the first place?
Yeah.
And if they call it Bodie McBoatface, the RRS Bodie McBoatface, won't it be the most famous boat in social media? I mean, the other options aren't fabulous. There's some really boring ones like RRS Polar Science Voyager, RRS Climate Hope.
It's bloody cold here. RRS, it's bloody cold here.
RRS Fish and Chips was pretty good. I don't know. I mean, these are just poor people.
I know. Well, the name was suggested on Twitter by someone who describes himself as a PR person. So maybe it what? Maybe this is all a PR stunt.
Well, it seems to be working. I think the next boat will probably be named in emoji if we're not careful. If we allow this to go through, which I think they should. You open it up to the internet to vote. You open anything like this up for people to name and to vote on it. You might as well stick to it. I think it's actually endearing. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Becky, it draws me closer to the boat, strangely. The McBoat.
Yes. Yeah. At least, sometimes these go so far wrong that they're just mean and, profane. But this, yeah. I mean, yes.
This works.
I want like Boaty McBoat face just oh, goodness gracious.
Apparently we'll have to vote for that then. Where is it at right now? I can't read the number there. Is it 45,000? More than 45,000 votes already for mm-hmm. it, so. Alrighty.
Well, Becky, thank you so much for joining us on this episode that was full of lots of giggling.
Ups and downs.
We did well. We were very mature in our discussion of large and small phones. I think we survived.
I think we did okay.
I think we did too. Well, what do you want to tell? Where can people find your work online?
What am I plugging today? What am I doing? I tell you what, I got a plan. I thought it was fitting today to go to my Twitter feed at bWorley. In May and June, I'm hosting the Parkinson's Moving Day in San Francisco and San Jose. It's a walk to raise money for Parkinson's research. And it was really a cool thing today to learn about Andy Grove and learn more about who he was as a person. He suffered from Parkinson's for a really long time. And so I thought this an apt day to say, hey, go to my Twitter. You'll find a link to Moving Day SF, and if you want to come out and join me or support me, if you are looking for a good cause, this is certainly one of them. It's one near and dear in my family, and I hope it's a tribute to a good man, Andy Grove, too.
Absolutely. What is the URL that people should go to for that again?
I have a link on my Twitter, so go to @bWorley on Twitter.
All right. bWorley on Twitter. Becky, always a pleasure getting you on. Thank you so much. And you're going to be back next week a couple of times. So
I know, and I got to fill in hosting for you, which is big shoes to fill because I've been listening to the show a lot with you guys, and you're just doing such a good job, and I really enjoy you as people and as hosts and as thoughtful, smart people who are doing this. So thank you for what you do.
Well, dang, thank you. That's awesome.
Well, we're going to miss you next week when you're here, but everybody else can see you. We're excited for that.
Thank you, Becky. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, guys.
Bye. All right. Tomorrow's guest will be the always awesome Jonathan Strickland from How Stuff Works. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show. Just email us, tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail. That's 260-TNT-SHOW. And find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
Subscribe to our show. That is the best way to get it. You can find all the ways to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to find me on Twitter, I am @MeganMaroney.
And I'm @JasonHowell, and my voice is going away somewhere. I don't know where it's going. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. Thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.